It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Fires burning up unprecedented amounts of land out west, killer tornadoes in Oklahoma, Superstorm Sandy, and record rainfall in Pennsylvania. How much of it is related to climate change or the unprecedented climate extremes between 2001 and 2010? According to a United Nations report released last Wednesday, the first decade of the 21st century was the warmest for both hemispheres and for both land and ocean temperatures since measurements began in 1850. More national temperature records were broken during that period than in any other decade, and the high temps were accompanied by a rapid decline in Arctic sea ice and an accelerated loss of the ice sheets of the world's glaciers. Joining us now in Studio A to provide a scientific explanation for what's causing all of this is John Rodzilowicz, Director of Science Education at the Carnegie Center in Pittsburgh, the Carnegie Science Center. John Rodzilowicz, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. What changes have you noticed in the climate here in your own backyard in western Pennsylvania? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. We'd like to hear from you. And John Rodzilowicz, what did you make of the UN report?
Well, there really wasn't anything terribly surprising in there. If you follow this topic, we sort of knew this was happening. But what I think is good is the attention that it's going to get by pulling all of this information in one place and saying, look, here's the data that we've got for this last decade. We can't deny this any longer. And that's, I think, the biggest benefit.
What is causing the rise in temperatures?
Well, the overall rise in temperature is really from a greenhouse effect. What we're talking about is the fact that carbon dioxide gas that's in our atmosphere allows sunlight in, but then re-radiates that energy in a way that traps it. And so we're seeing the overall temperature of the planet rise, somewhere in the neighborhood about 1.5 degrees Celsius over the last several decades. That doesn't sound like much, but when you're talking about the average temperature of the planet, that's a tremendous amount. And when we take a look at the planet, of course, that doesn't mean that we're going to see temperatures rise in every location, right? If you take a look at the climate of the entire planet, we have areas that are hot and cold, wet and dry, all of those things. But as we add all of this energy, begin to increase the temperature overall, we begin to change the patterns of heat flow. Where does the hot air move? Where does the hot water move? How do those things change? And as those begin to move, the climate begins to change in different locations. So some places that have been wetter are becoming drier. Some places that were drier are becoming wetter. Temperatures are increasing in some places, decreasing in other, and it's causing a dramatic change in our overall climate.
What causes the greenhouse effect? You just explained what it is, but what causes it? What is man doing to enhance or perpetuate the greenhouse effect?
Well, as it turns out, the main factor in the greenhouse effect happens to be water vapor. And that's not something we're making a terribly big difference on. That accounts for about 70% of the effect that happens. And again, it's about having radiation come in at one wavelength, invisible light, and being re-radiated at an infrared wavelength, which can't get back out through the atmosphere. But that 30% that's carbon dioxide, that's a significant chunk. And that's what we have changed dramatically over the last several decades. And as we change that piece, the overall amount of energy that continues to be trapped inside the Earth's atmosphere has increased.
So the greenhouse effect, it's trapping in gases that are increasing our temperatures.
Solar radiation. It's trapping the sunlight is really the way to think about it. The sun's energy is coming in, and as that energy is taken into the oceans and the ground, it's given back off as heat. The heat, that particular wavelength, can't get back out through the water vapor and the carbon dioxide.
So explain then how this is causing these unprecedented weather events that we are seeing, like Superstorm Sandy, the storm of the century, that some have called it, the wildfires, the tornadoes, one after another, hitting Oklahoma and causing widespread devastation.
Right. So the first thing we should say is it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to pick one particular event and say that particular storm was caused by global warming. We don't have the capabilities to do that because there are so many factors involved. However, we look at patterns. And as you said, the pattern is we're seeing more of these violent storms, more of these extremes in terms of wet and dry, hot and cold on the planet. That pattern is very clear. And it's really about a redistribution of that heat. As more energy is coming in, we're actually changing the way that the currents flow in the oceans. We're changing the way the air moves in the atmosphere. And as those changes occur, the patterns we've become used to about when the rains come, when they go away, when things dry out, when they become cooler, all of those are beginning to shift. And we're finding greater extremes between hot and cold. And those greater extremes are what spawn these incredible storms.
And I think you might have just explained this, but I think a lot of us are having a hard time wrapping our minds around the idea that this same phenomenon, this greenhouse effect, can be causing record drought and record rainfall at virtually the same time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How is that possible?
Well, because you're shifting things around, right? So you're taking water away from one place and putting it someplace where it hadn't been before. And so the place that's losing moisture is beginning to see drought. The place that's gaining moisture is going to see these torrential downpours, going to see flooding. At the same time, we're also increasing the total amount of water that's in the mix. And the reason that that's happening is as we're seeing the ice melt in the Arctic, we're seeing the ocean levels rise, we're actually increasing the total amount of water that's available in the atmosphere. So we're shifting it around and also increasing it at the same time. And so you will see, and this does confuse people a lot, especially the changes to cold areas. You can have places that are going to become colder and wetter because of this. But think about the way the planet is now. Right? Under what we've been considering normal circumstances, we have places that are desert and we have places that are rainforest already. What we're really doing is we're redistributing all of that. And when you start to do that, the plants and animals, including humans, who have adapted to the particular climates in their area, they're going to have a big problem.
We're talking with John Radziliewicz of the Carnegie Science Center. If you have a comment or question, would like to join the conversation, tell us your story about the weather changes that you've noticed, you can call us at 412-246-2002. We have Marty from Ligonier on the line, I believe. Marty, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you, and thanks for taking my call. I've heard over the last year or two from many different sources, diverse sources, that there has been no global warming on average, that the temperatures have been virtually flat for the last 15 years. And I would cite the Economist magazine's recent article discussing the near breakdown of all the models predicting higher temperatures. I'm not making a case either way. I'm just saying that I'm confused. I'm sure you folks have also heard the comments, at least, that there have been no significant increases in global temperature for the last 15 years.
Sure.
I wonder if you could address that in light of the United Nations statistics seemingly showing the opposite.
Absolutely.
What about the conflicting data?
I hate to accuse The Economist, but I read that article. This is what we call in science cherry picking. Picking the data that fits the conclusion you already want. And what they're doing is they really should be embarrassed by what they're doing, because in a basic high school science class, you would learn trends versus individual points and things we call outliers. So let's say we were going to measure temperature for 10 years. We'll make it very simple. First year, we measure 10 on the scale. Second year, 20. Third year, 30, 40. In the fifth year, it goes to 100. In the sixth year, it's at 50. In the seventh year, it's at 60. In the eighth year, it's 70. What's the overall trend? It's a clear increase, but we had this one big spike, and every temperature after that spike is slightly lower than that particular spike. And so you say, oh, look.
So you could use that to say,
we peaked in 1998. Every measurement, every average has been lower since then. That's what they're doing. They're looking, in fact, at one particular set of NASA data. And there are actually many other sets that show that 1998 wasn't actually the peak. 2005 matched 1998. And now the latest data shows that 2010 exceeded both of those. So it doesn't even hold up to that. But the story, the lie really, has come from the fact that they picked this outlier and said, oh, 1998, let's take that year and let's look at the 15 years after that. Oh, look at that. The temperatures are all lower. Never mentioning that they're increasing every year, even though they stayed lower than 1998.
Now, you talked earlier about and I mentioned that it was included in the UN report, that this rapid decline in Arctic sea ice and accelerated loss of the ice sheets of the world's glaciers. It's been documented in films. It's been documented now in this report. In addition to the fact that, okay, someone wondering, what does this mean? You mentioned it creates a rise in sea level, in water and ocean levels around the globe. What else does the melting ice mean for the planet?
Mm-hmm. Well, those are the two biggest things that I've already mentioned, the increase in water that you're seeing. And again, people look at the numbers and they say, well, what, this isn't much. The decade before that, 1.5 millimeters per year. This past decade, though, 3 millimeters per year. That doesn't sound like a whole lot, but if you live along the seacoast, if you live in New York City, that is a tremendous amount as you extrapolate that number out. And then the second thing is the total amount of moisture that's now in the system. A tremendous amount of water is locked up in those polar caps. As you begin to release that, it's not just what melts into the oceans and rises the level, but what goes into the atmosphere and is available for those storms that we were talking about. And that's why we see these torrential downpours. Where does the rain keep coming from? You've increased the total amount of water that's in the system because you've released what's in the caps.
So if we look back at the data in the UN report, and it goes back to 2001. What has happened since then? There's been Katrina. There's been Sandy. There have been others that I'm probably not thinking of. But can we attribute those? Certainly Katrina and Sandy are the two big ones. Can we attribute that to what the UN report is telling us?
Yeah, it's about trends. No scientist is going to point and say, Katrina, absolutely, that's global warming. What you do, though, is you look at the number of storms that you're having and the intensity of those storms. You know, the climate system is very, very complex. There are ebbs and flows all the time, and we can always look back and say, oh, there was a great storm in 1920. But we're seeing more of those storms by a significant percentage. So I think we were somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 more storms in that same period of time. So from 11 or 12 storms to 15, the number of storms that were Category 3 or higher had increased significantly. That's the kind of trend we're looking at. More storms and more powerful, and that's the danger.
We're talking with John Rodzilowicz. Again, he is the Director of Science Education at the Carnegie Science Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. We'd like to hear your story. We'd like to know what you've noticed. For example, many of us are noticing that the temperatures we're seeing in June and July and even in earlier months in the year are warmer than we can ever remember them being, that it's getting hotter sooner in the summer, that you used to have to wait till mid to late July for the really sweltering temperatures and maybe on into August in some years. But now we're seeing that happen sooner. Have you noticed something different in your life? More rain, more snow, whatever it is, we'd like to hear from you and have you share your story with us. 412-246-2002, the number to call. We had the one caller, Marty, who called in and mentioned the data that he saw that indicated temperatures were flat, which you refuted. What do you say to people who say that the rising temperatures, that even if there are reports that show the temperatures are rising, that what we're seeing is part of a natural climate cycle, and that this is not necessarily settled science?
Well, this has been investigated very thoroughly. And in fact, within the scientific community, it is basically settled science. The debate that you see is happening in the pages of the Wall Street Journal and The Economist. It's not happening in the peer-reviewed journals. And in fact, it's been fairly settled since about the mid-90s. And we've been looking at this since the early 70s. So we've had people who, for 4 decades, have looked at this.
So you're saying that the people in the scientific community, there's no more of debate about this.
Yeah, there have been a series of studies looking at everyone publishing on climate science. And it runs in the neighborhood of about 97% who not only say it's happening, but it's happening because of the carbon dioxide that we're pumping into the atmosphere. If you want to just get into the question of is it happening or not, you have nobody saying that in the science community. Everyone says clearly it's happening.
So now the question is whether it's man-made or not.
Right. But I should really point out for people listening, the idea that 97%, if you get 97% of scientists to agree on anything, that's an amazing number. And you hear people, oh, but it's not 98 or it's not 99, it's not 100. No, no, no. You have to understand. You know, this is true of humans in general, but scientists in particular, 97% saying this is what's happening. And the reason they can say that is they have looked at these other things. We've looked at the sunspot issue. We've looked at the changes in orbital dynamics that cause ice ages and cause the melting of polar caps. Those things have been investigated thoroughly, and there is clearly something laid on top of all of those changes, and it's very dramatic and very sudden. If you take a look at what's been happening since 1980 in particular, that increase is faster and greater than anything that we've seen in any of the natural cycles. That's the difference. And that comes from not just data that has been taken recently, but data that's been spread out over this entire period, 4 decades, but also goes back to things like ice cores. So, you know, in science, basically,
ice cores show over centuries.
Millennia.
Basically, it's a way to track temperatures.
Yes. And what we look for in science is we look for convergence of the data. Different teams who are unrelated working on different projects that are unrelated. And when that happens, that they all start coming up with the same answer, that's what gets scientists' attention. And that's when you start to see something like a 97% agreement with what's happening. Too many different lines of data all coming up with the same answer in different ways.
So as far as you're concerned, it's pretty – and as far as the scientific community is concerned, it's pretty much settled that there is in fact global warming and that we can trace it to what man is doing to the environment.
Absolutely. And it's unfortunate that actually we still have to have that discussion about whether it's happening or not. But the reason we have to is because we do have these other voices that are out there, some of whom are well aware actually, I think, of what's going on and yet deliberately distorting what's happening because they have financial benefit in the situation. Now, that really actually scares me because – you know, they have children and grandchildren too. What do they think is going to happen to their children and grandchildren 50 years or 100 years out from now? So it's really short-sighted in the most amazing way. And maybe they're hoping that it's going to turn out it's not the case. Well, you know, it is. We have the data showing this. And it's time to do something. You know, the time to debate whether or not global warming is happening, as I said, that's been settled for 15 to 20 years. Now we need to be doing something. In fact, we should have started doing something a lot sooner.
And that is the question. What do we do? What should we do as a country, as a society about global warming? We will continue our discussion with John Radzilowicz, Director of Science Education with the Carnegie Science Center. And we're going to bring in Joylette Portlock, co-creator and star of an independent video series on climate change. She'll talk about what we can do to reduce greenhouse gases. It's Essential Pittsburgh. We'll also take your calls, so stay with us. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are spending the better part of this hour talking about climate change, global warming, as some would prefer to call it, and what can be done about it. And we're talking with a couple of experts here on the program, John Radzilowicz of the Carnegie Science Center. He is the Director of Science Education for the Carnegie Science Center with us here in Studio A. And also with us is Joylette Portlock, who is co-creator and star of an independent video series on climate change, which talks about what we can all do to reduce greenhouse gases and the like. Joylette Portlock, welcome to the discussion. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. 412-246-2002. If you have a comment or a question, and we're focusing on what can be done about climate change in this particular segment of the program, and we'll take a call right now from Chris to start off the segment. Chris in Moon. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. Yes, I guess that is a big question. What can be done? It doesn't look very good. The fact that we're still having this conversation about whether or not climate change exists. It looks like the debate has been sort of skewed to keep putting off, inevitably doing anything about it. And, it looks like a zero-sum game at this point. Massive populations fighting for resources, et cetera, et cetera. But I'd like to hear something about that, if there is anything that can actually be done. I mean, practically. I mean, if it's a law, we can see what our Congress can get away with doing, which is nothing. I'd be interested in your guest's thoughts on what practically can be done.
Well, and interestingly enough, Chris, the president was able to bypass Congress with his latest action, which we're going to discuss. But as far as doing something, we have the right person with us, Joylette Portlock, whose video series on climate change is called Don't Just Sit There, Do Something. So I'll let Joylette take your question about what can we do.
Thanks. And thanks, Chris, for your call. I think that this is a very important question and one a lot of people are asking about whether it's too late, basically. Have we already run out the clock on this? And the answer, I think, is an unequivocal no. To be sure, the amount of carbon dioxide pollution that we've put up into the atmosphere since the start of the Industrial Revolution that hangs around for centuries or more is going to cause us some climate changes we're going to be kind of stuck with and going to have to deal with. But I think, and especially with the president's latest announcement, it's clear, there are many things that we can do to keep it from getting catastrophically worse across the next century. And so the president's announcement was really a pretty thorough plan that addressed a lot of the important subject areas that need to be tackled, all the different pieces of the climate puzzle, bringing down our carbon dioxide pollution, adapting our communities, playing ball internationally, which is something we've never done before. We kind of walk away from the table at international meetings. But I think it also is done in a smart way because, as you've said, congressional debate is lengthy and difficult at this current juncture. So this plan does a very smart thing in doing as much as possible through the powers of the executive branch. So calling for regulation of carbon pollution by the year, new rules for that for power plants by the year 2015.
So you think that this is an effective first step?
I do. I think it's a very effective first step, and it should be applauded as such. It certainly by itself isn't going to get us where we need to be, but it definitely addresses all the major areas and puts us squarely on the path to restoring climate stability, which is something we've very much needed, as John Reilly points out, for some time.
In his second inaugural address, the president vowed to, quote, respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that failure to do so would betray our children and future generations, end quote. Is he finally making good on his promise? And if so, what has taken him so long? He didn't do anything nearly as significant as what he's doing now in his first term.
That's true, and I'm not sure I'm the right person to speculate about all the myriad political reasons why that could be the case.
But if I'm sure in suggesting the action that you recommend people take, that part of it is overcoming the roadblocks that our government and politicians and business community sometimes set up.
I think that's right. And I think that there have been obstacles to making this kind of change in the past. Certainly, dealing with a Congress that has punted on this so many times. The one thing I did want to mention, though, too, is that this is not some regulating carbon pollution as a pollutant by the EPA, which is what the president is calling for, is not a radical measure by any stretch. In fact, in 2007, during the Bush administration, the Supreme Court said, yes, you have the authority and the obligation to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. And we've been kind of waiting for Congress to take that on and deferring to Congress for all this time. So EPA doing this now, Obama having EPA do this now, is not, far out there. It's much overdue.
What do you say to those who think that this plan is committing what is being called by some economic suicide? That all we're doing, all the president is doing, is needlessly killing thousands of jobs and leaving entire states impoverished.
Right. That tends to be the argument that comes up whenever we talk about regulating any kind of industry. But the facts don't bear it out. basically, if you look at not just what's projected, but what we've actually seen in other states that have taken on regulating carbon in the absence of federal regulations, is that we get more jobs, we get a decrease in electricity cost to the consumer because of energy efficiency measures and because of the regulations that put these energy efficiency measures in the pollution reduction. Ten northeastern states after New Jersey dropped out, I guess down now they're down to 9. But in the first 3 years of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, they added over $1.5 billion to the local economy with the regulations. It was because of the regulations.
Okay, so you cutting electricity, cutting use of electricity is one way to create extra cash. But what about creating more jobs? If we're losing jobs, as some are citing, by creating more regulations on the coal industry, will switching over to cleaner, renewable forms of energy create new jobs to replace those being lost in the coal industry?
Yes, and I think that is the case. You get not only, you know, a decrease in energy demand that produces a decrease in energy cost, but you also see more jobs implementing these energy efficiency
such as
standards. Contractors that go out and install, you know, smart meters or, you know, energy efficient insulation in homes. You get a boost in the economy, both in terms of dollars and in terms of wages from these new jobs. You also see, I'm glad actually that you brought up the idea that we're going to decrease so many coal jobs. When I hear that, I find it's kind of interesting to me. If you look at coal jobs over time, coal's been shedding jobs for around the last 100 years. It's been a steady decline. And that's not because of Obama's policies. That's certainly not because of climate regulation, because we don't have any at the federal level yet. But, you know, that's because technology has made it so we need fewer workers to do the work. And in recent years, that's because natural gas has become cheaper. So we're switching over to using that more. But I think that even if you look at the natural gas boom, we still have renewable electricity, renewable energy as our fastest growing energy sector in this country. So that's something that I think that we should really be looking into, building up the energy of the future for our state and for coal states.
412-246-2002 if you'd like to join the conversation with Joylette Portlock and also John Radzilowicz. And we have Charlie from Clairton, where they have the famous Clairton coke plant, I should say. Charlie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good afternoon.
How are you, Charlie?
I'm fine. Great. I have a question for either one of the hosts dealing with Albert Bates's book, Biochar Solution, where he's somewhat advocating that if the bottom 2 billion people on the planet were using cleaner burning biocharring stoves, could make a significant impact by sucking carbon out of the atmosphere while we get around to deciding whether we're going to find political solutions. I wonder if they could comment on this, if they're familiar with it.
Biochar. So you're saying that you're wondering what our guests think of reducing CO2 by making biochar.
It's really charcoal. Let's call it charcoal. But if it's intentionally made to enhance the soil, then it is considered biochar, used by Native Americans. And the Phipps display suggests that it was the source of the terra preta soil in South America. So I wonder if they could comment on that.
Personally, I'm not familiar with that book or that process. I'm wondering about the math of it, as I think you talk about the numbers. To pull out the levels of carbon dioxide that we're talking about, it would seem to me that you'd have to have an extremely large process to do that. But I can't say. I haven't read that book. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, I haven't either, unfortunately. But I did want to mention, you bring up an interesting issue about ways to bring down the pollution while we figure out these kind of bigger policy solutions. And there are plenty of ways to bring down other substances that are polluting our climate. So carbon dioxide is the most common pollutant, but there's also methane. There's also black carbon and other things that don't stay in the atmosphere for nearly as long. But if we can bring those down by doing things like getting cleaner burning wood stoves into parts of the developing world, by decreasing industrial emissions of those compounds as well, then we can buy ourselves maybe a little bit of time, which would be a good thing.
412-246-2002 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. I wanted to mention, Joy, the United Nations report released last Wednesday that John and I were talking about in the first segment. The first decade of the 21st century, according to this report, was the warmest for both hemispheres and for both land and ocean temperatures since measurements began in 1850. What was your reaction when you saw this and when you heard about it and realized that we are setting records here in the last decade?
I think my reaction wasn't that different from John's, quite honestly. I don't think there's a lot in that report that is really surprising, again, to if you've been following these numbers for some time. I do want to, you know, say that, you know, as we look at the increase in heat that we have seen and the links to increased, you know, numbers of heat waves, increased, you know, numbers of droughts, increased amounts of heavy precipitation days in various parts of the country, which, as you rightly point out, we've seen here in Pennsylvania. You know, there is also a cost associated with all of this as we start talking about the cost of regulations tying back to that. I mean, we've spent in North America, there have been $500 billion in insured losses since 1980, which is significant, and that says nothing of the terrible human cost. So another thing to factor in when we start talking about the cost of doing these important regulations to really preserve our future and build the cleaner energy that we all need to see.
And we're talking about global warming during the majority of the program today. We'd like you to join the conversation with our guests, Joylette Portlock, who is co-creator and star of an independent video series on climate change called Don't Just Sit There, Do Something, and also John Radzilowicz of the Carnegie Science Center. He is the director of science education at the Carnegie Science Center here in Pittsburgh. Coming up a little bit later on the program, an interview with National League Cy Young Award-winning pitcher R.A. Dickey on overcoming enormous obstacles in his life and mastering the mysterious pitch known as the knuckleball. But as we continue our discussion and focus on this United Nations report, which just came out, there is some data that is, in light of this news, rather astounding. And that is a Pew poll on climate change indicates, according to a recent column by syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer of the Washington Post, that among the concerns of American citizens, and on a list of 21, climate change is at the bottom of that list. Again, this is a Pew poll, and climate change rates at the bottom of the list of American concerns. So some are wondering why President Obama is even bothering to address this. If Americans don't care, why bother to do anything?
Well, I mean, let's think about this. Charles Krauthammer is largely responsible for that result, right? He's one of those voices out there telling people at every turn it's a hoax, it's not really happening, the data's no good. And that's what I think that reflects, that report, is that people don't understand. The American public, unlike most of the people in other countries, are getting this distorted view of what the debate is. And you and I actually, Paul, have talked about this a little bit before, about the role the media plays in that. And it's so often when global warming is discussed, they've got someone to talk about the science and someone to refute it. And so people come away saying, oh, well, look, I just heard two people fighting about it. I guess, you know, we don't really know, so why should I worry about that? And that does not represent what's happening in terms of the scientific consensus. And so I think the American public has gotten confused. They say, well, you know, everybody's going back and forth. If no nobody knows really what to do. I got to worry about things where we all agree.
Are we that gullible? If the evidence is there, then why can't Americans figure this out for themselves?
I think that the answer comes. It's not so much gullible as John is saying. It's uninformed. I've also seen recent polls from April saying that 65% of the American public believes they need anywhere from a little to a lot more information before making up their minds about climate change. When you have a consensus like the one we've got in the scientific community and you compare it to that number, it's kind of astounding. And back to your original question about the on the list of issues, you know, I think that we need to change the way we think about this in this country. Our polling is kind of all over the place. Our polling is kind of all over the place on this issue. People care about climate change. They believe, you know, there should be action on climate change. But then when you give them a list like this, they always rank it near the bottom. I think that the way we think about this needs to change from climate change being on a list of other issues to climate change being a lens through which we look at all these other issues. You can't talk about national security. You can't talk about our long-term economy. You can't talk about, you know, education. You can't talk about health without considering what's happening to our changing climate and what we're planning to do about it. So, you know, I think that those numbers kind of belie this underlying concern that really applies to all of these other issues as well.
412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Steve in Johnstown. Steve, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Having me. I want to go ahead and address something, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the naive nature of individuals to think that governments or corporations are going to go ahead and get behind these kind of ideals. I want to speak more towards what us as individuals in boroughs, in communities, in lieu of any support from the corporate structure or from governments around the world, how can we as people take the steps necessary to handle these kind of situations? Because over the course of the last decade or so, it seems quite apparent to anybody that's been paying attention that they're not going to get any real help from governments or from the corporations that go ahead and control these kind of resources, because there's just too much money at stake. So I just want to know, what has me as a person and within my community, within my borough, within my state, what can I do to combat these kind of situations on a practical level instead of a more, you know, relying on the government, relying on Congress?
What can we as individuals do about climate change? It's a good question, Steve. Joylette, I'll let you handle that.
Sure. Yes. Thanks, Steve. And, you know, and there's a lot that we can all do. So I'm glad that you asked the question. There's a lot we can all do at all levels, at individual levels, in our communities, in our states, in our regions, at the federal level and globally. I think we need to act at all of those levels. And this is something that we talk about in our video series. I encourage you to go to dosomethingaboutclimate.com and check out our videos, because we always include actions that individuals can take as well as plug into the larger advocacy actions that are out there to try and really, you know, push on a couple different levels at once. So individuals, obviously, to reduce the amount of pollution that you're responsible for, there are plenty of efficiency measures that you can take around your home. And those can be simple things like turning down your hot water heater and, you know, installing power strips so your computer is actually off when it's off, to, you know, more extensive things like installing insulation, instead of, you know, throwing out all of your waste. You recycle, obviously, but because that saves energy, but also, you know, composting, green waste is a great way to not just become more energy efficient because you're throwing out way less garbage, but to also become more resilient and start to build, you know, more resilient communities. And that was another good thing, actually, that came out of the president's plan, was this effort to connect communities and connect states in their planning for, as we're dealing with these changes that are coming, ways to build, you know, more resilient communities. And there are a lot of efforts out there for doing all of that that can be plugged into as well.
We have just 2 minutes left, but I will ask one. I will take one final stab at being devil's advocate here. According to the International Energy Agency, the United States has already cut CO2 emissions more than any other country on Earth since 2006, and that emission levels are back down to 1992 levels, but global emissions have gone up. So if we can't control the energy use of the rest of the world, does it really make a difference what we do, what the government does, what we as individuals do?
Yes.
Yes.
Coming to the table internationally will make a huge difference in, I think, those numbers. And also, you know, even though we've reduced, it's still, we haven't gone nearly far enough to
right.
achieve climate stability.
You know, at this moment, China and is doing more damage than we are. India is coming right up on our heels. But the fact of the matter is we're still in that top three. We're
yeah.
still doing tremendous
and
damage.
And China's investing
and so
more than
more.
Us in renewables. And
that's
China's
right.
in putting in a carbon tax, you know, next
so,
year.
So do we want to cede leadership to other nations to do this, or do we want to take the lead?
But what about when China and industry, China and India say, you know, the United States, who are they to say after all this time making all this money, but now we're going to, now that you're ready to position yourself to make money with industries that pollute, that now we're going to clamp down on the standards?
Well, but interestingly, though, as Joylette has said, they actually are thinking about this already. They're ahead of us
yeah.
on putting you know, restrictions in place. So that's a little strange.
We've been passing the buck with China back and forth for a while now. But, you know, at the end of the day, two wrongs don't make a right. You know, we've got to solve the problem. We've got to roll up our sleeves and get to it.
Indeed. Good advice from both of our guests today on Essential Pittsburgh. Dr. Joylette Portlock is co-creator and star of an independent video series on climate change called Don't Just Sit There, Do Something. Joylette Portlock, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks.
And John Radzilowitz of the Carnegie Science Center, thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, all-star pitcher R.A. Dickey on the art of the knuckleball and overcoming personal problems to become successful in the major leagues. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.